This is the Center for Strategic and International Studies weekly podcast, Smart Women, Smart Power. It's made possible by Citigroup. Here's your host, Nina Easton, senior editor and Washington columnist, Fortune Magazine, chair, Fortune Most Powerful Women International, and senior associate at CSIS.
Welcome to the latest episode of Smart Women, Smart Power. This is Nina Easton, and we're coming to you from the Washington headquarters of CSIS. Our topic today is Iran, and our guest is Danielle Pletka. She's Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. She spent a decade with the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and she's a familiar face on news shows and a familiar name on op-ed columns on foreign policy. With another deadline for nuclear talks with Iran looming on November 24th, attention will turn to the U.S. relationship with Iran. But while attempts to keep nuclear weapons out of Tehran's hands are at the center of our concerns, the question on Iran right now is bigger, for there are serious geopolitical shifts going on that likely enhance that country's power, with great meaning for the region, for us, and for our closest ally there, Israel. So, Danny, let's start with the big picture. Some say the U.S. and Iran are facing a common threat from the terror group ISIS. So, Danny, some say that with the U.S. and Iran facing a common threat from the terror group ISIS, and we're seeing the easing of sanctions in order to pursue talks over a nuclear program, they're actually in a detente with Iran. Is that something you would agree with?
First of all, thanks for having me, Nina. Do I agree with that? You know, I think there are a lot of people who would like to suggest that we are on the verge of a detente with Iran. Sure, we do have common enemies. Absolutely. The Iranians are afraid of Sunni Islamist extremists. They're absolutely afraid of ISIS, and seeing what ISIS has done in Iraq and in Syria is very worrisome to them. But, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend is not a good guidepost for foreign policy, except maybe in the game of Risk. And the reality is that sometimes both sides are wrong. In this case, we've got serious problems with Sunni extremists in the Middle East. We've got ISIS, we've got Al-Qaeda, we've got Jabhat al-Nusra, we've got a lot of other Sunni extremist groups throughout the region. But the Iranians are backing their own brand of extremist terrorist groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and their own breed of murderous tyrants, Bashar al-Assad being only one of them.
And we've actually softened our stance somewhat towards Hamas, had negotiations and talks with them this summer. Can you talk about that?
We have softened our stance, and when I say we, I don't mean me. I mean the Obama administration. It's a little bit strange to a lot of people on Capitol Hill, Democrats and Republicans alike, because Hamas is a designated terrorist organization. The fact that the Obama administration has been willing to sit down with Hamas and allow U.S. foreign assistance to continue to flow to the Palestinian Authority, even when there's a Hamas Fatah, the other Palestinian party, partnership in power there has concerned a lot of people. Hamas remains a terrorist group. They are believed to be working on the border of Sinai with Al-Qaeda. They are continuing to threaten the state of Israel. They continue to work on the other side with the Iranians. They're bad all around.
So speaking of terrorist groups, let's talk about ISIS and how that plays out with Iran and the U.S. There was talk at one point that not only is we have this common enemy, but we might need to work together. Has anything played out on that front? What is Iran doing vis-a-vis ISIS right now?
Iran is on the ground in Iraq. The head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, has been seen in Iraq repeatedly. He wants to be seen in Iraq. They want the world to know, and they want the Iraqi people to know, that they are helping the Iraqi military fight ISIS. So they're definitely on the ground there. They are definitely fighting ISIS, and they are definitely not succeeding at what they're doing. They also have ground troops inside Syria. Actual Iranian military ground troops in addition to the Quds Force, their main terrorist supporting spearhead, and their proxies, Hezbollah in particular, on the ground in Syria. So they are absolutely fighting with ISIS. They are also fighting with Al-Qaeda. And they are fighting to keep bad guys in power. That's what we need to remember, is same enemy, different goal.
And we'll get to, I think, who you're referring to, Assad, in a minute, because you've had some interesting things to say about that. But going back to what you just said, why has there been no success against ISIS?
Why has there been no success against ISIS? It is kind of strange, isn't it? If you think about this group, we didn't really know very much about them a couple of years ago, and now suddenly they're so powerful that we can't push them out of small cities in Syria or out of Iraq. And the answer is, first of all, it's not a new group. ISIS is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they were beaten in 2011. They were down, but they weren't out. They're now on their fourth leader. And the truth is that the group has been, as they've been moving forward, been extremely disciplined. They have been victorious, which has been a magnet to other extremists, including extremists from Al-Qaeda and from the Taliban and from elsewhere. They have very good operational security, because when they control territory, if information gets out about them, they kill you. No bones about it. They kill you. So they have been moving forward, and each place they go, they've been stealing or taking money, resources, people, and weapons. What we've been doing is bombing from the air in partnership with groups that, frankly, are not strong enough, coherent enough, or organized enough to beat ISIS. In other words, the winning team really isn't put together on our side.
And you've got ISIS, of course, with tremendous economic funding, both from kidnappings and oil that they control now, correct? Millions of dollars coming in a day to ISIS.
That's absolutely right. They've got an enormous amount of money. And you're right that it's coming from the sale of oil. It's also coming from kidnappings, extortion, hostage-taking, crime. Plus, it's coming from the state of Qatar. And it's important to understand that while the Qataris claim that, in fact, it is not they who are directly funding ISIS or Al-Qaeda, just individuals inside Qatar, the reality is that the Qataris have been supporting these sorts of Sunni extremist Islamists throughout the region, including in Libya, where we've seen them take over the country, and in Syria, and now in Iraq.
And so, again, turning back to Iran and its attempt to fight ISIS, so they're not having much success either.
No, not yet. I don't think that we're seeing the Iranians really, really winning, if you want to call it that. But they have a problem. This isn't their territory. So what they should be doing, of course, is helping the Iraqis. They're limited in their capacity, and that's what we need to understand. Also, they're not all in. Instability is very appealing to the Iranians, and that's another problem that I talked about before. We need to understand that while we may share enemies, we don't share goals. They have no desire to see a stable, strong, independent Iraq on their border, just as they have no desire to see a stable, strong Sunni-majority Syria on their border. They would prefer instability. Middle East people call it the Lebanonization of these countries. That's what the Iranians have done there, and that's what they're doing in the rest of the region.
And so let's talk about Syria. They, of course, want Assad to remain in power there. You've written that Team Obama won't say Assad must go. There's no reason other than sucking up to Iran. What did you mean by that?
That was rather nastily put. it was in a blog post that I wrote, and you know, I've been really frustrated watching the president, because it took him a really long time to say that Assad must go. But he said it in 2011. And then he was even tougher in 2012 during the course of the presidential race with Mitt Romney, when he wanted to burnish his national security credentials. And that's when we saw all that stuff about red lines. The problem is, having said that Assad must go, we have done absolutely nothing to get him to go. And now the choice has been made on the part of the administration, and even adherents of the administration will agree to this, to downplay hostility towards Assad in order to make nice with the Iranians for this sort of strange bank shot on the Iranian nuclear negotiations. Yeah, you know, if we let them keep their pal in Syria, then maybe they'll think we're good guys who understand their strategic priorities, and they'll give up their nuclear weapons program. It sounds like a Saturday Night Live routine. There's another problem here, too, and I don't want to go on too long about this, but it's important folks understand this. The Turkish government, which has its own set of very serious problems, will not help us help the Free Syrian Army, will not help us to fight in Kobani, this contested town on the Turkish-Syrian border, because the United States will not explicitly help in getting rid of Assad. As a result, the Turks are holding back, all because the president thinks that he's playing this particularly clever card with the Iranians. It's a huge mistake.
You know, Anne-Marie Slaughter just said to me recently, and she's a former top Obama State Department official, she said, we need to bomb Assad's Air Force. Is that the strategy that we should take?
2011, I think, maybe later. General Jack Keane and I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal. We had another one this year. In the first piece we wrote, we said, go after the Syrian Air Force. People need to understand how important this air power is to the Syrian regime. First of all, the air bases are used for resupply from Russia and from Iran. Okay? Second of all, they're used to take off and attack with chemical weapons and with bombs, Assad's enemies. And if we had been willing to take those out earlier, we would have taken away such a vital lifeline to the Assad regime that we may never have had to confront the rise of ISIS.
Interesting. We missed an opportunity.
We've done nothing but miss opportunities, and we're continuing to do it today.
Let's talk about a moment that this administration and a lot of others thought was an opportunity, and that was the change in Iranian leadership. When the current president, Hassan Rouhani, he took the place of, frankly, a frightening figure in Mohammad Ahmadinejad. When he took his place, there were high hopes that we could move forward, that this was actually a moderate force. Was there any reason for that high hope?
Hassan Rouhani is a very different character than Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and I'd say he's a lot smarter, just to put it crudely. Ahmadinejad was playing to a different audience, an Iranian domestic audience.
And a more populist audience,
and
correct.
A much more populist audience, and he succeeded in completely screwing up the Iranian economy to the point that he became terribly unpopular. And I think we need to remember that we think of Iran in the context of terrorism and nuclear weapons and human rights violations and killing American soldiers, but the Iranian people think of it in terms of bread lines and basic goods and unemployment and inflation, and they're right to think about that. So Rouhani came into power, and he campaigned on a much more pragmatic platform. He belongs to a faction within the regime that is more pragmatic. They're clerics. They are of that particular group inside Iran. They're less affiliated with the military than Ahmadinejad was. He made some practical promises about negotiating with the West, about stopping the gratuitous denial of the Holocaust, for example. But we shouldn't forget that he remains part of this regime and that he serves at the pleasure of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And that, I think, is where people went too far. They believed that, in fact, he was hostile to the basic aims of this regime. And the answer was no, no, no. He remains the same steel hand, if you want to put it that way. He's just wearing the velvet glove. And as a result, we've gotten very, very little out of the Iranians in the course of the negotiations that have been taking place.
I want to talk about that in a minute, but let's, sticking to the country itself, it's interesting that it's a big, complex, educated country. There's a pro-American spirit among the people there, correct?
There has been, and I haven't been in Iran, so I only speak from hearsay. A lot of the pro-Americanism comes from antipathy towards the governing regime. And a sense that, well, if America is against them and we're against them, then America must be okay. I don't know how deep the pro-Americanism, because don't forget, it's been a long time since the revolution, 1979. People who were born after the revolution are adults and not just barely adults. So this is really a generation, even a generation and a half, that has grown up under the education system of the Islamic Republic. How pro-American are they? I'm not entirely sure. One thing I'm certain of, they can't stand their own government. And that has always played to our advantage, and that we've been willing to call the Iranian regime what it is, an oppressor of human rights, a threat to its neighbors, a failure to its own people. When we cease to do that, I suspect the Iranian people will actually cease to be as pro-American.
You know, what's always puzzled me is that you do have this very educated, fairly worldly population there, and you have this repressive regime, and yet we don't see the emergence of leaders, dissident leaders, who would stand up to the regime. Why is that?
Well, we've seen the emergence of enormous numbers of dissident leaders inside Iran, and in 2009, they came out into the streets. And they had done that previously as well. And each time, first of all, the person who was in the White House, whether it was George W. Bush or Barack Obama, did nothing for them, failed to provide even moral support to Iranians standing up for their rights. And they were brutally, brutally repressed. Mm-hmm. There are thousands in Evin prison who are there for their political views. There is a police state in Iran that is all-pervasive. They have control of newspapers, of the internet, of meeting places, of universities. They control Friday sermons. They control religious education, secular education, insofar as there is any. Iran is not a place that is free. And people fail to appreciate just how successfully this regime has corralled free speech inside the country.
That's so interesting. Now, of course, going back a year, we have this opening for a nuclear arms talks with the regime. Tell us how that started and what we've seen since.
Well, when President Obama came into office, one of the things that he said when he was running was that he planned to reach out to Iran with an outstretched hand. And I didn't agree with his position, but I don't think that anyone could suggest that he was fooling people as to what he was about to do. You know? And he was voted into office, and my view is his platform was voted into office too. And I think he had a mandate to do just that. So he reached out to the Iranians, something that was unsuccessful until a couple of years ago. But with the election of Hassan Rouhani, there was a real opening. And the Iranians decided that their approach was failing them. It was more and more sanctions. The Americans were gathering more and more allies to our side. More and more was being exposed about the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And as a result, the Iranians changed their tack. Very smart. So we have the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the Security Council.
And those members
plus
being?
Germany. So we have France, the UK, Russia, China, the United States, plus one, that's Germany. And we're all theoretically negotiating together, although, as I think everybody would say, it's pretty much America and the Iranians right now. And so these negotiations have been going on for some time.
And we dropped sanctions, what, $6 to $7 billion worth?
Well, when the Joint Plan of Action was agreed upon last year, last November in 2013, by the parties, there was an agreement that the parties would take a step back, that the Iranians would get some sanctions relief. Not substantive legislative relief, not even relief through the United Nations Security Council resolutions, but through some mechanisms that were available to the various parties, including frozen assets in the United States and some other relief that came from the European powers. So, great. Big windfall for the Iranians. $4 billion, $7 billion, a lot of argument about how much they got. But there was no question that it was a breath of fresh air. The Iranian stock market shot up, Iranian currency values shot up. Suddenly there were many more goods available on the Iranian market, and it was a reversal of what had been a downward spiral for the Iranian economy, and that was very important to the Iranian leadership, just as it's important to any leadership. Problem is, where have we gotten on the aspects of Iran's nuclear program that trouble us and the International Atomic Energy Agency? And the answer is, we've given up the vast majority of the tough demands that we made. The Iranians have given up very, very little. And we're coming up on the one-year deadline, which was the agreed-upon deadline last year in the Joint Plan of Action, and I suspect there isn't a deal to be had.
And what have they given up?
The Iranians have given up some things that, and we shouldn't downplay them, that were of concern to the international community, something, a heavy water reactor at Arak. The Iranians agreed to stop installing pieces of it. They agreed to slow down work on it. And they agreed to a slowdown of the startup date of this reactor, the sole purpose of which appeared to be to have a plutonium program. They've also stopped installing new centrifuges, but we don't know how many centrifuges they've manufactured. They've made a couple of other small concessions, but what everybody is focused on are the, everything has an acronym these days, the PMD, the possible military dimensions of the Iranian program. And there the Iranians have given absolutely nothing. And I say that having sat down last week, a couple weeks ago, with two experts from town, one from Carnegie, one from ISIS, not the terrorist group ISIS, but the well-known group headed up by David Albright, who assesses these things, and both of them agree that the Iranians have given up nothing on the possible military dimensions of their program. That's very troubling.
So, given what you know, if their program just stopped as it was now, how far away is Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, time-wise?
So that's really the $64,000 question, isn't it? It's very hard to answer because so much goes to the question of verification. Well, if we knew everything about the Iranian program, if we had complete visibility into it, and the Iranians didn't restart aspects of their program that have been slowed down, then they would still be pretty close to having a nuclear weapon. They would probably be just a few months away, should they decide to do it. For a lot of us who watch Iran, the real question is, who is going to make this decision? And the challenge is not to get the Iranians away from having a nuclear weapon. It's getting Iran away from a position where it will, at a time of its choosing, be able to break out with a large number of nuclear weapons and change the balance of power in the Middle East forever. And we really haven't backed far enough away from that.
So are you saying there's acceptance that they would probably have a nuclear weapon? It's just a question of whether they have an arsenal of nuclear weapons?
I think most of us agree, and none of us have seen into the mind of the Supreme Leader, but I think most of us who watch Iran pretty closely agree that Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapon. These are not the North Koreans. They're not nutty. They're not stupid. They're not lousy negotiators. And I don't think they want one weapon. What they want is they want this card in their hand. And when they have it, they don't just want one so that we can go and bomb it. They want a bunch. And that's very important to them. Now, again, I have no reason to know this. Ayatollah Khamenei just stopped confiding in me. I don't know what happened.
I don't know. You must not have been kind enough to him.
I might have said something mean on Twitter. I don't know. But that's what the assumption is. And the Israelis believe that Iran is 1 to 2 years away from a nuclear weapon. I hate those sort of estimates because if you go back and you look at them, it makes everybody look like an idiot. The Iranians have always been 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 4 to 5. I mean, is tomorrow never going to come? And so I think that the challenge really is to ensure that there is a system of verification in place that keeps such a close eye on the Iranians that in fact it will mean that should they choose to go forward with a nuclear weapon, we will have ample advance warning. And we're not there yet. And I think even those negotiators, those really ardent negotiators who are representing President Obama and the talks that are ongoing with the Iranians, recognize that we haven't gotten close enough.
So, Danny, as you know, you've been around a long time on this topic, and this isn't the first stab at nuclear diplomacy with Iran. What is the history of it? How does this game play out typically?
Well, these are by far the most serious and sustained talks with the Iranians. They're the first talks that have really put issues on the table with a minimal of posturing and a maximum of secrecy. And from that standpoint, I think that they are not unserious talks. The problem really is that there's so much left out there. Our first position was you can't have any centrifuges. You have no right to enrichment. The Iranians' position was, no, we have a right to enrichment. The president said it. Our experts said it. No, you have no right. Then the Joint Plan of Action came out, and it envisioned, in fact, an end state in which the Iranians had enrichment. Well, there goes that demand. But some years ago, we were not just not demanding that they have no enrichment. We were demanding that they not convert yellow cake, the most primal ingredient here, into UH6, into uranium hexafluoride, which is then fed into the centrifuges. So our, quote, red lines have moved again and again and again. And the Iranians now have a very substantial program, where at the beginning they didn't. So, you know, on the whole, I'd say that the goalposts have been moving and the Iranians have been doing much better in these negotiations than we have. The better set of negotiations is a lesson to look to are the North Koreans. We had an agreed framework, same negotiator, Under Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, during the Clinton administration, okay, who's now negotiating with the Iranians. North Korea's tested 3 nuclear devices. That's not what I call success. I'm afraid that we're going to make a terrible deal with the Iranians at some point, that as the Iranians cheat on it, we're going to cover for them in order to protect our agreement, to make it look like it's still working. And then finally the Iranians are going to turn around and say, oh, well, you know what, we really didn't like it. This didn't work out for us the way that you said it would. And so now we're going to break out. That is how I ultimately see it ending, and that's what's worrisome to a lot of people.
So in this game, how effective are sanctions? I mean, clearly the regime now is trying, at least rhetorically, to say we're going to create an economy that's self-sufficient so we don't have to worry about, you know, economic sanctions from the world. I'm not sure that they can actually do that. But how effective are sanctions, and how much ability do you think they have to kind of insulate themselves from sanctions?
The Supreme Leader likes to talk about the resistance economy. Yes, he's really a fine, fine economist. And with that sort of stewardship, indeed, Iran doesn't need sanctions. They can just drive themselves down the toilet. The real issue about sanctions is that there's the substance of sanctions and there's the psychology of sanctions. The substance of sanctions are countries unified, countries together, working together to ensure that there are no gaps in this wall that prevents the Iranians from doing certain kinds of business, that prevents them from selling oil, that prevents them from buying certain things, not food and medicine, but other things, that denies them access to the international financial system. They can't get letters of credit. Those sanctions are, in my mind, gone. Not because they're physically gone, because their infrastructure is still in place, but the psychology of it is gone. We had the Russians and even the Chinese on board with these sanctions. The Iranians have given basically nothing, and the momentum is all in the other direction. I can tell you, just talking to lawyers in town who do sanctions enforcement, just from the corporate side, not from the Treasury side, but you know, companies come to them and say, hey, can we sell these great tires to the Iranians now? And the answer is, no, you can't. And the companies are saying, oh, yes, we can. And they're lining up. And the administration will insist, no, sanctions are still in place. And the answer is they are, but the psychology is done. The wall has been breached, and putting that back in place again will be extraordinarily difficult. And the Iranians know it. And if they can slow roll the process so that we continue to give little pieces and we don't put new sanctions in place, which is exactly what they're planning on doing when we reach the November 24th deadline, all the better for them. Eventually, we'll just give up.
So, Danny, in 2012, we were all on pins and needles convinced that Israel was going to launch an airstrike at Iran to take out its nuclear facilities. We don't hear much about that anymore. What's gone on?
I think a lot of us really expected that the Israelis would do that. And the Israeli defense minister at the time, Barak, even talked about it. The Iranians have so really successfully hardened their nuclear program to the point where an Israeli strike would be an enormously complex undertaking. Could they do it? For sure. The Israelis could hit a number of sites, Natanz, which is an enrichment site, Fordow, which is an enrichment site, Parchin, which is a military site where nuclear testing and explosive testing is done, and a number of other sites are all there. But could they destroy the program? No. And they can't take away the know-how from the Iranians. And this really is the future of the region. This is the challenge that all of us are going to face up to, which is that the engineering feat that the North Koreans pioneered, digging tunnels, hardening programs underground, has now spread so far. We see Hamas with tunnels in between Gaza and Egypt. We see Hezbollah, and the Israelis now believe that Hezbollah is building tunnels underneath the border from Lebanon to Israel. And we see that the Iranians are building their nuclear facilities into mountains. Now, that's not cement. You need something very, very serious to destroy a mountain and get to what's inside. And for the Israelis, that's a very tall order. The bigger question is, why? And it's a question a lot of us are asking.
Why what?
Why did the Israelis not take the moment that they had to hit the Iranian program? I can tell you that sub rosa, behind the scenes, one Arab head of state after another was saying, do it, do it, do it, do it now, now's your chance. And yet the Israelis chose not to. I don't know whether it was because they believed in the power of the negotiations with the United States and others, or whether they believed that the consequences to Israel would be so great, or whether they believed that they would always have a shot, that they could always do it at any moment, the moment of their deciding. I don't think those things are true. And just like Ayatollah Khamenei, Prime Minister Netanyahu's not confiding in me anymore. I don't know what's in his head, but I do know that this would have been a much easier job for Israel had it been done some years ago.
And the window's closed.
It's sure close to being closed.
So as we wrap up here, Danny, it's prediction time. Two predictions from you. One, will there be an agreement November 24th? And the more difficult prediction, 2 years from now, will Iran have a nuclear arsenal?
I don't think there will be an agreement on November 24th, not for want of trying, but because the challenges and the outstanding issues are just too complicated. And because, frankly, I think that in Tehran there's fear about what a deal would mean. Don't forget that the notion of a resistance economy or a resistance state rests on the idea that you are resisting something. If you're suddenly getting together with the permanent five members of the Security Council and all cuddling beautifully around a table, that doesn't really look like resistance to me. And the other thing is that the Iranians are demanding that sanctions be lifted immediately, and that's not feasible. Because even though the president has some latitude, he doesn't have all of the latitude. So I don't see scope for a deal on November 24th. I think that they'll find an elegant way to move forward. Indeed, the Iranians have already made clear that they're ready to do just that in exchange for a payoff to be negotiated, I'm sure, just before November 24th. In 2 years, where will Iran be? I don't want to sound like the Israelis. 2 years they're going to have, and then reach 2 years and they don't. I don't know. But I know that the Iranians are shrewder, more committed, and more fixated on the notion that a nuclear weapon will be the kind of insurance they need to ensure regime survival. This is where people go wrong. They think Iran wants nuclear weapons so they can just nuke people, nuke Israel, give it to Hezbollah. I don't think that's why they want it. They want it because it raises the cost of taking Iran on, and what they want is a region and a world in which the calculus is it worth it to anger nuclear Iran? Probably not. Let's just let them do it.
It makes them the powerhouse in the region, and by default.
And that's exactly right. As I said, they're not dumb. They're strategic-minded. And unlike the United States, they come to work every day with one idea in their minds. I am always impressed by the Iranian capacity to achieve their goals.
Danielle Pleca, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
After this interview, news broke about a secret letter President Obama sent to Iran's supreme leader seeking to tie the nuclear talks to efforts by both countries to combat ISIS. We caught up with Dani Pleca to get her reaction.
Well, this is the fourth letter of its kind that the president has sent to Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader. And to my understanding, he's never gotten a direct response. I'm not entirely sure why the president would again take this step. One of my colleagues, Matt McInnes, likened it to you know, a spurned girlfriend sending notes to her unresponsive boyfriend. It really does have that vibe. And the problem is not just to those of us who are critical of the president. I think it also has that vibe to the Iranians, that it was actually a dangerous choice, and it betrayed a lack of understanding of the Iranian strategic calculus that I think is going to hurt us a lot as we go into the final stage of negotiations before the November 24th deadline, the self-imposed deadline for a nuclear agreement between the international community and Iran. There's another problem as well. It's not just that it sends a message of naivete and of desperation to the Iranians at a critical moment. The other problem with the letter is that, like the previous ones, the president didn't share the details or even the fact of the letter with any of our closest allies. So the Israelis, the Emiratis, the Saudis, everybody, and the Europeans, the British, the Canadians, they found out just when you and I found out through public information, and they are furious. They already mistrusted the president on this. They already mistrusted the American negotiating team. Now they find out that the American leader has been trying to back channel with the supreme leader in Iran. How can this be good? When you're negotiating on something as important and as dangerous as the Iranian nuclear weapons program, you need to be tough. More importantly, you need to be savvy. I really question, because of this letter and some other things, of course, whether the administration is savvy enough to cut a decent deal that's acceptable to the American Congress, to the American people, and to our allies.
Thank you for listening. For more information, go to csis.org and subscribe to our podcasts.